This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home.
It's Thursday today. I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow, but sometimes you just never know about these things. But I think all in all, we're doing okay. Everything's puttering along. We're getting stuff done. We're moving forward. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's been a good week at work. All is well. Got some things accomplished on all the fronts we were supposed to get things accomplished on. So that's good. I may be kind of changing things up a little bit with my fasting schedule. We'll see. My birthday was this last week, so 61 now. And on Sunday night, I was going to run sound at church, and so I knew that was going to put me long. Normally, I eat up until 8 o'clock on Sunday, but I knew I'd be at church for a good portion of that, and I probably wasn't going to make it back home by 8 to have a snack before I started my fast, and so I thought, you know what? It's my birthday. Maybe I'll give myself a birthday present because with all of this, in order to get into autophagy, there is some disagreement as to whether or not it takes 24 hours or 48 hours to get your body to kick into autophagy. And I've been doing 2 44-hour fasts a week. So there is the potential that while I am getting some benefit, I'm not necessarily getting all the benefit that I could if I would fast for 48 hours as opposed to 44 hours. So I thought, you know what? It's my birthday. So... maybe, since I'm running sound at church anyways, I'll just say that I stopped eating at 5:30 on Sunday, which I had actually stopped eating, I don't know, about 5:15, because I got ready and headed in, but I thought, well, we'll just call it 5:30. Because I knew we were having a dinner at the house on Tuesday night. I was going to be at 5:30 or 6, and so I thought, well, you know what? Let's just try this. Let's try it. Instead of taking that last, that last half hour at work and starting to eat at 4 o'clock, which is fine. I can kind of gobble and write it and do the stuff I need to do at work at the same time. But, I mean, it is something else that's, you know, happening. Potentially somewhat of a distraction in that last half hour of work. I thought, let's just power through that. Let's just see how this goes. So it went fine. Went fine. Got back home about, I don't know, 5 o'clock-ish, a little before 5. Setting up tables, setting up chairs. There was plenty of stuff to do. It's always funny because when it comes right down to that last 10 minutes or so, that last 10 minutes or so of the 48-hour fast, you're looking at the clock going, come on! But made it to 5:30, didn't have any troubles, it was fine. So that was a full 48 hours. And then I ate and we had party, and so I had eaten until 8 o'clock. And so then I started a fast again on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. And then I thought when I got up today, you know what, I could start eating at 4 o'clock this afternoon, or maybe I'll just wait. So I didn't even pack myself some food. And I'm going to go home and bustle around and get the podcast uploaded and do a few things like that, maybe do a little writing, and then, who knows, maybe 7 o'clock-ish or so. You know, we'll see. Or I might wait till 8, and if I wait to 8, until 8, that means I will have completed 2 48-hour fasts in a week, and then maybe if that all works out fine, I might just start doing a thing where I stop eating Sunday night at 5 and then wait until Tuesday at 5 to eat, and then maybe try to eat just for 2 hours on Tuesday, and then start again at 7 and then wait again till 7 o'clock on Thursday night. And I think I can make that schedule work pretty easily. So then I'll have my 48 hours just in case it's 48 hours as opposed to 44 hours. I don't know if the body is that, you know, accurate, if it's got a little countdown in it. But, you know, if you're going to get some benefit, you should just get some benefit. Anyway, so that's all fine. The writing's going fine. Had a lovely birthday party. Tuesday night, had some friends down, and the kids were down, and it was good. We just sat around and jabbered and ate some food and talked about this, that, and the other, and so, yeah, it was good. It was good. It was good. It was good. So anyways, that's all going fine. I'm working along on my ugly Christmas sweater outfit based on A Christmas Story. I've got my dude cowboy shirt all finished up, as much as it's going to be for now. I've got my cowboy hat all finished up. I have the chap, the one chap, since only one leg is going to have a cowboy chap on it, with the cow print pattern on it. I've got that put together Tuesday night after the party, at least pinned together. I've got to do the seaming tonight with the seaming tape stuff, since I don't sew. But that was pretty simple. Get that done. And then got to get started on the leg lamp stuff. Figure out how I'm going to engineer that with the lampshade, etc., etc. So this will be fun. I'm really more and more convinced that I can get this done where it will just be funny, not offensive. You know, even to maybe go up at my major client. We'll see. I think I could get this done, because it's just goofy, stupid, silly, ridiculous. I saw a sign the other day that I thought, yep, that's me. In the back of this truck, it said something like, I would rather be absolutely absurd than absolutely boring. So, yep, there you go. Anyway, so that's all going fine. Simultaneously to the Christmas sweater outfit, or Christmas ugly Christmas sweater outfit, I've also been working on Polka Dot Day, which is in January, and then simultaneously I've also been working on Steampunk Cupid, because in 2020, Valentine's Day is on a Friday. So I thought, well, Valentine's Day is on a Friday, I should just go ahead and do something for that. So I'm working on that as well. So that's all fun. The writing's going fine. Finally getting back to that. It took a little detour there, but the writing's going fine. Because I ran sound on Sunday night, that threw me off a little bit. Normally, I just stay home from church on Sunday morning when I'm running sound on Sunday night, but my granddaughter was baptized. I had water baptism this last week, and we all went out as a family after that, and so of course, I'm going to go there, but I was within 750 words of my normal 3,000 words on a Sunday, and so that has been cascading through the week. Let's see, in addition to that, I lost Tuesday night as well, so I may be as much as 1,500 words down at this point this week, but, you know, I've got a good Friday and Saturday, whereas last Friday was kind of a work day. I've got both Friday and Saturday, and we only have one more load of gravel coming out. So, we got to get that taken care of on Friday, but that shouldn't take too long, and I can write through most of that, so I should be able to get caught up and get to 10,000 words for this week, and then have one more week of writing for book 12, and then that gets put aside. I should be at 75
5,000 words on that. That gets put aside, and then I go back to edit. And then there's a little bit of wiggle room in this particular part of the schedule because I actually stop 2 weeks ahead of time so that I can start editing whatever book is out to the beta readers so that I can have a week off during Christmas. But I don't usually take a week off. What I end up doing is just sort of writing around the edges while the family and we get together and play games and all that sort of thing. So it should all be fine. And I may have a little extra time I need anyways to peel off to get this ugly Christmas sweater outfit done, because there's a lot of work with this. There's a lot of pieces. This is the most complicated one I've ever put together. But that's okay. You know, once it's done, then I've got it. And then I can wear it for the next 2 or 3 years on ugly Christmas sweater day. Which, as a sidebar, there actually is an ugly Christmas sweater day. It's the third Friday in December. There actually is an ugly Christmas sweater day now, third Friday in December. But my third Friday in December is actually Elf Day, so I back it up to the second Friday in December. So, fun stuff. You know, it's just fun. It's fun. So, all is well. Things are puttering along. All is well. I've had some nice comments on book 11, which is what's out to the beta readers right now. It's interesting. Right as of this point in book 12, I don't know what the epilogue's going to be. I have an inkling, but I don't know what the epilogue is going to be. And that's fairly significant because theoretically, the epilogues are where I ring the bell, where I hit the moment and try to make people cry. And you've got to have a very specific type scene to get that done. And I ain't got it yet. I've got some little hints as to where it might be, but I ain't got it yet. And even as I'm saying that, my brain is percolating. So it's going to be interesting to see. And what's fascinating about this is I have thought about this even today. It's like, you don't have the epilogue yet. You know, and of course the flesh is going to go, "Ooga, booga, booga, booga. You're not going to get it." But then I remember there's been other, I mean, this is book 12. So there's been plenty of books where I didn't know what the epilogue was going to be. And then all of a sudden, as I just kept writing, it just landed. It was like, "Oh, there. Oh, that'll work." You know, so I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting to see where the epilogue's going to land. This one. It'll be fun. Anyways, so just want to put that down as a stake in case grandkids are listening. In case you're listening to this, my beloved, beloved grandchildren, in case you are listening to this at some point in the far-flung future, I want you to know that he is faithful. And then in the midst of creative endeavors, you can trust him. As you're moving forward, it will work out. Put a stake down in the ground. As I'm fond of saying, when you're in the middle of it, when you're in the middle of the crisis, you can either trust him when you're in the middle of it, or wish you had trusted him after it's all over. Because one way or another, Jesus is going to be with you through that crisis. So that's not a question. It's not a question of whether Jesus is going to be with you through the crisis. It's going to be a matter of whether you trusted him in the middle of the crisis or whether you wish you had trusted him in the middle of the crisis. So for me, I try to trust him through the middle of the crisis to where I can look back and say, "See, I knew you were going to be faithful. I believe in you.
that you're going to be faithful. So we'll just see where the epilogue ends up on book 12. I think we'll be fine. Anyways, okay. So this week, I am not going to do justice to this article. I can tell you that right now because I'm just holding on with my fingernails on this article, and I think I know what they're talking about, but I can't tell you for sure because I'm a little weak on the mathematics. Because it's a long story, in high school there was sadness. And I could be stronger on mathematics, but I decided to go into music. Which was an interesting turn and brought about interesting things in my life and put me exactly where I needed to be at the right moment. And if I had gone into mathematics, there probably wouldn't have been a finale, which was the music notation program that I wrote. So that all worked out good, but it does mean I'm a little bit weak on mathematics, and I've never taken the time to go back and sort of shore that side of my life up. Who knows? Maybe after I retire, I'll have a little extra time and I'll go shore that up. Just like, who knows, maybe I'll learn another language. We'll see. We'll see. Anyway, so the title of this article was The Extraordinary Link Between Deep Neural Networks and the Nature of the Universe. I thought, oh, that sounds interesting when I read this. So the article is talking about the oddity that neural networks are really good at solving complex problems. And the article talks about the fact that in the last few years, that deep learning techniques have transformed the world of artificial intelligence. One by one, I'm quoting from the article, one by one, the abilities and techniques that humans once imagined were uniquely our own have begun to fall to the onslaught of ever more powerful machines. Deep neural networks are now better than humans at tasks such as facial recognition and object recognition. They've mastered the ancient game of Go and thrashed the best human players, which, by the way, that's AlphaGo, is the deep learning machine that did that. There is a documentary on Netflix about AlphaGo, and it's fascinating. It is really fascinating. According to this article, but there is a problem. Quoting again. There is no mathematical reason why networks arranged in layers should be so good at these challenges. Mathematicians are flummoxed. Despite the huge success of deep neural networks, nobody is quite sure how they achieve their success. Okay. They're magic. And they are developing tools, from what I understand, to examine how the neural networks are making their decisions. But there's still a component of magic to some of these things. And they are modeled, as much as we understand how the human brain works, they are modeled on how the human brain works. Although the caveat that I would add to it is that I'm not sure we can say for certain that we know how the human mind works. We have come up with a model for the human mind that we think is pretty close, and then based on that model, we have developed neural networks that seem to work pretty good. But at the end of the day, I don't know that we can say, yes, that's how the human brain actually worked, because we did a podcast on that several ago about the fact that the human brain might be vastly more complicated, vastly more complicated than we are estimating. So, on the basis of all that, we have developed neural networks. And these neural networks work really well, and they do some amazing things. But maybe no one is quite sure how. I'm getting my mail in a moment. The car was rocking forward just a little bit there. Oh, little mail. Good. Let me just check below here and see. Nope. Okay. I have to do a little tree trimming here. Gotta do a little tree trimming on Friday because we got a little note from the post office that said you got too many branches in front of your mailbox and you need to fix that. So I'm gonna do a little trimming. Well, it shouldn't be too bad. We'll just trim back a little bit and it'll be fine. Anyway, so you got these neural networks and they are doing amazing things. Training and they train them on stuff, like show them a bunch of pictures of dogs and cats and they can recognize what's a dog and what's a cat. And they're really fascinating and they do a great job on it. And somehow these layers of networks are able to put together something that approximates what we do in terms of pattern recognition. So that's very interesting. So there is actually a new study out from Harry Lin at Harvard University and Max Tegmark at MIT. And these two guys say that the reason that why mathematicians have been so embarrassed is that the answer depends not on mathematics, but the answer depends on why neural networks are so successful, on the nature of the universe. In other words, the answer lies in the regime of physics as opposed to mathematics. So he said in the article, they say, so if you want to consider an example of classifying a megabit grayscale image to determine whether or not it shows a cat or a dog. Okay, you have to understand that you've got this image. It has a million pixels in it. Okay, little dots, a million of them. And those dots can each take on one of 256 grayscale values. So if it's 0, it's black. If it's 255, it's white. If it's 128, it's gray, perfectly gray. And it's only lighter gray and darker gray, depending. It gets lighter gray as you go towards 255. It gets darker gray as you go towards 0. Now, so you have a million of these values. They're arranged in a square or whatever, a rectangle. And now you're supposed to analyze those. So in theory, the article said, there can be, how many zeros is that? 2.5 trillion possible images. And for each one, it is necessary to compute whether it shows a dog or a cat. Now, that seems pretty complicated. If you're going to write some kind of mathematical formula to figure out whether that's a dog or a cat. And yet, quoting from the article, and yet neural networks with merely thousands or millions of parameters somehow manage this classification with ease.
And they said the problem is that there are orders of magnitude more mathematical functions than possible networks to approximate them. And yet deep neural networks somehow get the right answer. So Lind and Tegmark, these two scientists, say they've worked out why. They said that the answer is that the universe is governed by a tiny subset of all possible functions. Now, okay, this is where I'm getting into the spot where I'm getting wiggy, but I have something I wanted to point out here. Possible functions. In other words, when the laws of physics are written down mathematically, they can all be described by functions that have a remarkable, remarkable set of simple properties. And therefore, these scientists say, deep neural networks don't have to approximate any possible mathematic function, only a tiny subset of them. So they said, okay, to put this in perspective, consider the order of a polynomial function, which is the size of its highest exponent. So a quadratic equation like y is equal to x2 has an order of 2. And yet the equation y is equal to x raised to the power of 24, or y is equal to x raised to the power of 2, I should say. Okay, the equation y is equal to x to the power of 24 has a 24, order of 24, and so on. Obviously, the number of orders is infinite, and yet only a tiny subset of polynomials appear in the laws of physics. Quote, this is from Lind and Tegmark, quote, for reasons that are, excuse me. I got another one coming. Maybe not. Okay. This is a quote from Lind and Tegmark. Quote, for reasons that are still not fully understood, our universe can be accurately described by polynomial Hamiltons of low order. Typically, this is not their quote anymore, this is from the article. Typically, the polynomials that describe the laws of physics have orders ranging from 2 to 4. So the laws of physics can be described with simple equations. Also, the laws of physics have other important properties. For example, they are usually symmetrical when it comes to rotation and translation. Rotate a dog or a cat through 360 degrees and it looks the same. Translate it by 10 meters or 100 meters or a kilometer and it will look the same. That also simplifies the task of approximating the process of cat or dog recognition. These properties mean that neural networks do not need to approximate an infinite multitude of possible mathematical functions, but only a tiny subset of the simplest ones. They go on to say there's another property of the universe that neural networks exploit. This is the hierarchy of structure. Quote, elementary particles form atoms, which in turn form molecules, cells, organisms, plants, solar systems, galaxies, etc., say Lind and Tegmark, and complex structures are often formed through a sequence of simpler steps. This is why, This is why the structure of the neural networks is important too. The layers of these networks can approximate each step in the causal sequence. Okay, so this is another quote from them. Quote, we have shown that the success of deep and cheap learning depends not only on mathematics, but also on physics, which favors certain classes of exceptionally simple probability distributions that deep learning is uniquely suited to model, unquote. Back to the article. That's interesting and important work with significant implications. Artificial neural networks are famously based on biological ones, so not only do Lind and Tegmark's ideas explain why deep learning machines work so well, they also explain why human beings can make sense of the universe. Evolution has somehow settled on a brain structure that is ideally suited to teasing apart the complexities of the universe. This work opens the new way for significant processing in artificial intelligence, blah, 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 blah. Last quote, quote, strengthening the analytical understanding of deep learning may suggest ways of improving it. Close quote. The article concludes with deep learning has taken significant strides in recent years. With this improved understanding, the rate of advancement is bound to accelerate. Okay, so here's what's interesting to me. Okay, I mean, we go back and we say, quote, for reasons that are still not fully understood, our universe can be accurately described by polynomial Hamiltons of the low order. In other words, mathematics is unreasonably effective when it comes to understanding the universe. You can have guys who sit in a room and can think things up that can be taken into the physical universe and proven through experimentation. Einstein sat in a room and came up with theory of relativity. Niels Bohr and his cohorts sat in a room and wrote down a bunch of equations that proved to be extremely useful in quantum mechanics in the real world. The universe just happens to be organized in a way where mathematics is extremely useful and mathematics can be extremely useful in the real world. Okay. And then we go on to say that evolution has somehow settled on a brain structure that is ideally suited to teasing apart the complexities of the universe, except the universe, which seems like it could be extremely complex, can be described by very simple mathematics. So we have a universe that just happens to be explainable with simple, fairly simple mathematics, and we have human brains that just happen to be designed to understand those mathematics. This seems very fortuitous. It just seems like, well, we're not sure why the universe can be explained with mathematics, and we're not sure why the human brain is so good at mathematics, but it all just worked out fine for us. I mean, it's not a matter of life just somehow spontaneously came about. It's a matter of life not only somehow spontaneously came about, but somehow developed into intelligence and consciousness. And somehow that developed intelligence and consciousness just happened to be tuned so that it could understand the universe. Okay, this seems a little contrived, if you'll pardon the term. And I don't mean it in a negative connotation at all. But this seems like this was just set up for our success. And this idea that life is not only amazing in itself, but that life and our environment seem uniquely tuned to intelligence is an idea that's not original with me. There was a book called The Privileged Planet. And the point they made in that book was not only is Earth tuned for life, but it's also tuned for intelligent life and tuned to make incredible discoveries possible at just the right time, which is really fascinating. And what this article is saying, in essence, is that our universe seems to exist in a certain way that makes our brains, which exist in that same certain way, capable of making discoveries. I'm not going to say capable of actually understanding the universe, but at least capable of making discoveries and understanding the beauty and symmetry that there is in the universe. Because the Apostle Paul tells us that all creation speaks of his wonder and of his glory. And just by looking at the universe, humans should be able to figure out that there is a divine. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.